Book 3, Dust to Dust. Hollow footsteps, cloaked by night of sadness, known through tortured sight. The willow weeps its tears of woe, as owl moans the twin moon's glow. With whispers through the willow's leaves, an owl, perched high, eternal, grieves. Raven drinks the blood of Sigmar's dead, but soon flies off to hidden bed. Weary, neath death's black spell, the dead know pain that none can quell. Cursed to fight those they loved, forever lost, each journey taken, plagues the mind, the nights awaken. Troubled visions, thoughts of yesterdays that seem like beacons, lives away. Random comforts cannot ease their soul, for knowledge takes its weary toll upon one who suffers with each breath, who slept once in peace, then awoke in death. Chapter 15. Reunions. Though the sun was newly risen, light was already bleeding from the sky. The Azaborn battle line was silhouetted on the brow of the hill, 300 men and almost 100 women and children. Boys as young as 6 held long daggers, and men in their 70s gripped felling axes as they awaited the coming of the dead. Maeve kept Ulrik and Freya's boys close, trying to hide her fear from them. The desire to flee smouldered in the hearts of everyone, and all it would take to ignite would be one spark of fear. The Queen's eagles held the centre of the line, 30 warriors in leather armour and golden-winged helms. Each bore a long spear and carried a short stabbing sword. Their presence was all that gave Maeve hope they might withstand one attack at least. Alaric had split his warriors into 2 groups of 50, placing one on either flank. These redoubtable warriors bore wide-bladed axes slung across their backs, though each was presently armed with a heavy crossbow and bolts as thick as Maeve's thumb. 500 against 4,000. It was the odds of which sagas were made. After 5 days of forced marching, it felt strange to be simply waiting for the enemy to reveal itself. The Azaborn way of war was to strike hard and fast, wreaking as much damage as possible before withdrawing and dragging the enemy onto the blades of the spearmen. To wait for the enemy to attack felt wrong, but what else could they do? Maeve felt a small hand tugging at her sleeve and saw her daughter looking up at her with wide, determined eyes. Maeve's heart ached to see Ulrik afraid, but this was what it meant to be an Azaborn. Battle had to be given and courage earned in the face of fear. As much as Maeve hated the idea of Ulrik fighting this foe, it would be the making of her.
"Are the bad wolves coming for us?" said Ulrik.
"Yes, dear heart, they are," said Maeve.
"But we'll see them off, won't we, just like we did before?"
"Yes, just like then, but this time we'll make sure they don't come back." Ulrik nodded and gripped her bow tightly.
"Good," she said,
knocking an arrow to her bowstring.
"I wish my father was here. He'd ride over them on his horse, and that'd be the end of them, wouldn't it?"
"I wish that too," said Maeve.
"But the gods have already blessed us today, so we must be grateful for what they have given us." "How do you come to that conclusion?" said Sigulf, his features pale with worry. "The gods haven't blessed us. They've forsaken us."
Maeve knelt beside the boy, his fair hair plastered to his scalp with sweat. His green eyes were wide and fearful. Sigulf had the soul of a poet, and though he had proved himself a capable fighter, Maeve knew his heart was only truly free when he was writing music and composing verse. His twin brother answered him,
"Because they have sent us an enemy to test our courage and the strength of our sword arms."
Where Sigulf was a gentle soul, his twin was a warrior born and bred. Fridlifer loved to fight and had made a name for himself among the Azaborn as a fist-fighter of some repute. Skilled with sword and axe, he was happiest when the blood flowed and death hung upon every heartbeat. Just like his father, thought Maeve.
"They've blessed us because they gave us a beautiful morning and sent strong friends to stand beside us," said Maeve. "Ulrik knows that no warrior should fight alone, and has sent us the warriors of the mountain holds to fight at our sides."
"But we're going to die," said Sigulf, his voice quavering.
"The dead are coming to kill us." They'll try to kill us, but I won't be dying today, and neither will you, little brother," stated Fridleifr. "These are Azerborn lands, and we are the sons of a warrior queen."
"But the Iron Men said Mother was dead," said Sigulf.
"Aye, but I'll not believe it until I see her on a pyre," replied Fridleifr. And Maeve heard the strength and determination of the boy's father in his words. Both boys possess qualities of their sire, but only one man of this age embodied such greatness combined. "I'll wager a fist of gold she'll ride over the hill and send these bastards over the world's edge." The boy's voice lifted with every word, and Maeve saw his conviction that they would live through this fight spread to everyone in the battle line. Even the Queen's eagles took heart, and Maeve was surprised to find that even she dared to hope he might be right. A dwarf horn sounded a warning from the end of their formation, and Maeve saw the Blood Drinker's army for the first time. The sky above the enemy blackened like dead flesh around an infected wound as a morass of carrion birds, bats, and blood-sucking insects took to the air. A single, vast block of skeletons, 200 wide and 20 deep, marched towards the Azerborns in perfect formation, their bodies armoured in scraps of iron and rusted bronze. Their spears rippled in unison as they brought them down, serrated tips aimed at the hearts of the mortal warriors opposing them. The Blood Drinker rode in the midst of 100 black-armoured horsemen, his brilliant white cloak streaming behind him in the cold winds that blew around the deathly army. Wolves howled and loped around the dread host, filthy, diseased mockeries of the noble heralds of Ulric. Exposed muscles and withered meat hung from their bones, and their jaws slavered with rotten saliva. Worse than all of that was the fact that many of the dead warriors had clearly once been Azerborns. Everyone gathered on the hillside had family who had marched to war beside the queen, and the thought that they might come face to face with a loved one was almost too much to bear. Maeve felt the hope drain away from her people at the appearance of the foe. The sight of so unnatural a horde, an enemy of life itself, struck at the very core of what made mortals great. To fight this enemy would test the courage of even the mightiest warrior. And the Azerborns gathered on this lonely hilltop were old men and children. Yet, though these people had either hung their swords up years ago or had yet to be formally blooded, not one moved, and not one gave voice to the terrible fear stabbing up from their soul that told them to run, to flee this battle, and perhaps earn a few precious hours of life. Maeve had never been prouder to be a warrior of the Azerborns. There was no attempt at parley. What would be the point? And no theatrical displays of martial prowess. The dead marched to the bottom of the hill and began climbing towards the Azerborns. "Do you want me to kill him?" asked Laridus, working the whetstone across the blade of his sword. "Because I will if you need me to." Count Aldred shook his head.
"No, though don't think the thought doesn't appeal."
"It could be made to look like the dead did it," pressed Laridus, "or that he sickened."
"Enough," said Aldred, fetching himself a drink of water from an earthenware jug on the table of what had once been the seaward officer's barracks of the citadel. The Raven Hall was no more, and his servants had been sent to Reichdorf, so this was what he was reduced to, pouring his own drinks and sitting in a draughty room with no more appointments than a junior officer. Still, it was better than a great many of the Endels were forced to endure. The barracks were cold and damp, the sea air having long since warped the wood around the windows, letting in the clammy dampness of ocean mist.
"I know they're up to something," said Aldred, "but I don't want you to kill him. Think how it would look if Marius were to die while under my protection."
"I told you, my lord," said Laridus, "it could be made to look like the enemy killed him."
"No one would believe that, least of all Marica." "Does that even matter? You are the Count of Marburg. In any case, it's war. Who's to say what happens in the midst of a battle?" "And what of the other Juturns? Do you plan to kill them too?"
Laridus looked uncomfortable with the idea of such mass murder, but he straightened his back.
"If that's what it takes to keep you and this city safe, then that can be arranged too. There are 300 Jutone warriors here, not including Marius's lancers," pointed out Aldred. "Even the Ravenhelms would have their work cut out in killing those men, and I rather think we need those lancers to help defend our city."
Laridus nodded, though he clearly was deeply unhappy at the idea of relying on Jutones for anything.
Laridus had fought the Jewtones on many occasions, and there was no love lost between the two tribes, though that was changing. Ever since Marius had ridden out to rescue him, Aldred had seen the beginnings of camaraderie between the two tribes. That should have been a good thing, but he couldn't help but feel it was the death knell for his city and its people's way of life. Aldred stared into the fire. It crackled with the little wood remaining to them that hadn't been commandeered to craft fresh arrows and stakes for the defences behind the walls. It felt like evening, but the sun had risen only a few hours ago. The attack of the dead had shifted the diurnal cycle of Marburg, turning it into a ghost city in the daylight, a furious battlefield by night. He pulled his cloak tighter about himself, feeling a chill deep in his bones that had nothing to do with the temperature of the room.
"You should open your cloak, my lord," said Laridus. "Let the fire's warmth get to you."
"I know. It's tiredness playing its part. But I feel the touch of the grave deep in my heart, you understand?"
"I do, my lord," said Laridus. "It's settled in every man's bones since the army of the dead sailed into Marburg. And I expect it'll only lift once we defeat them."
Aldred smiled mirthlessly with a shake of his head. "Forced from our homeland to a scrap of land in the midst of a marsh. Our king slain, the pestilence of the mist demons ravages our city. And now this. We are not a blessed people, are we?"
"We are the Endels," said Laridus. "Hardship makes us stronger."
"Then we will be the strongest tribe of the empire by the end of this war," said Aldred.
Laridus tapped his fist against his breastplate in response, and they lapsed into a comfortable silence, content to simply drink and enjoy this rare moment of quiet. Aldred wanted to close his eyes, but sleep brought nightmares and festering thoughts of being devoured by the wriggling creatures beneath the earth. When sleep did come upon him, he woke scrabbling at his eyes, fearing writhing masses of worms were feasting upon them.
"You still haven't said what you want to do about Marius," said Laridus.
"There's nothing we can do," said Aldred. "To kill him, you'd need to slay all his men too, and that will simply hasten our ending. And I still have a hard time believing Marica would conspire with Marius. She's my sister."
"I'm just telling you what I heard," replied Laridus.
"That's just it, though. You didn't hear it."
"One of my men did, and that's good enough for me."
"Who was it?"
"Darian, one of my scouts. I had him assigned to the princess as a bodyguard, and he has the keenest eyes and ears I've known. He can see a hawk a mile distant and hear a whisper on the other side of Seafront Tavern. If he says they were talking about your death, then I'd wager a ship's worth of gold it's true."
"She still blames you for what happened with the mist demons," said Laridus. "Even though you weren't at fault, it was Idris Gwilt skewed your judgment. She must understand that."
"I had hoped she would by now," agreed Aldred. "But that woman can hold a grudge like no other. She reminds me of it at every turn, like I wanted to sacrifice her."
"You had no choice," said Laridus.
"No, I didn't," said Aldred. "I did what I thought was best for my people."
"And the people know that, even if she doesn't," ventured Laridus.
Aldred caught the hint of something unsaid, something too terrible to be given voice without tacit permission.
"What are you saying?" said Aldred. "You can speak freely."
"I'm saying that perhaps we're looking at the wrong person to kill."
Aldred looked into Laridus's eyes, seeing no give there, only a fierce determination to protect his count.
"America?"
Laridus nodded. "It's terrible and unthinkable, but I'm trying to save your life."
"By killing my sister?"
"She's trying to kill you. You don't know that for sure," pointed out Aldred. "Do you want to die to prove me right?"
Aldred said nothing, but the idea had already taken root.
The blood drinker unsheathed his sword, and it glittered in the encroaching darkness with spectral light. Thunder split the sky above the Azaborns, and a crackling bolt of lightning zigzagged in a bright tracery, arcing downwards to be captured by the vampire sword. The blade swept down, and the wolves sprinted towards the mortal prey at the hilltop. In their wake, the skeletal warriors began marching uphill. Maeve watched them come, her mouth dry and her bladder tight. Sweat moistened the grip on her bow, and she flexed her fingers. She put an arrow to the string and pulled back, sighting downhill at the loping wolves.
Those Azaborns with bows followed her lead, bending their bows towards the howling beasts. "Remember to aim high," she shouted, knowing that many archers would send their shafts into the earth when aiming at targets downhill. Maeve sighted on a wolf with a ragged pelt of decaying fur and one side of its skull exposed. The green corpse light shimmered in its eyes, and she let fly between breaths, sending her shaft slicing through its jaw. It ran on for a moment before collapsing in a dissolving mass of bone and rotten meat. 200 arrows slashed downhill, but despite her advice, most thudded into the earth in front of the charging wolves. At least 50 of the creatures were undone before they could reach the Azaborn lines. A flurry of crossbow bolts hammered the dead warriors behind the wolves, each one punching through rotten flesh and bone to slay the warp power at its heart. Every single bolt, loosed by a dwarf crossbow, found its mark, yet the dead marched on. Ulrich's first arrow struck home, as did her second, though her third went wide of the mark. Maeve was able to loose three more times before the unnatural beast reached them. She swapped to her sword as the wolves crested the summit of the hill. Snarling and clawing, they leapt with jaws stretched wide. Maeve plunged her sword into a wolf's belly, spilling its decaying entrails to the earth. It screamed as its body was destroyed. A wolf snapped at Ulrich, but the young girl ducked and rammed her knife into the creature's neck, tearing out the remains of its throat in a welter of grey meat and bone. Another snapped at her, but Maeve's sword swept down and ended it. Swords and spears flashed in the dim twilight, and wolves died, but a score of Azaborns were pulled to the ground. Fangs snapped shut on skulls, and throats were torn out with single bites. Rotten claws opened bellies, and thrashing wolves howled as they ate the flesh of those they had killed. Maeve fought side by side with her daughter, each protecting the other as though they had trained as sword maidens for years. Sigulf and Fridlifer did not fight with bows, but with exquisitely crafted swords given as gifts to the queen by the dwarfs of the World's Edge Mountains. Long before Sigmar had sworn his oaths of brotherhood with King Kurgan, the Eastern Queens had counted the dwarfs of the mountains as their allies. As different in character as they were alike in skill with a blade, Sigulf fighting with clinical precision, Fridlifer with furious passion. The Queen's eagles protected the heirs to the Azaborn crown, sweeping forward and fighting with all the skill that had seen them elevated from the ranks to become the guardians of Azaborn royalty. Gar fought at their forefront, his twin-bladed spear cleaving left and right as he hacked wolves down with every stroke. The wolves attacked all along the Azaborn line, bounding around the flanks and punching through to attack the weakest members of the Azaborns. Alaric's dwarfs swung around like an opening gate, protecting the flanks and preventing the wolves from getting behind the battle line. They fought with mechanical strokes, relentless and merciless, hewing diseased flesh as easily as a butcher would prepare a bull's carcass. No claw or fang could penetrate their armour, and no wolf could pass them. Immovable and impenetrable, the dwarfs anchored the Azaborn defence. In moments, it was over. The wolves destroyed and the battle line restored. The moans of the wounded were somehow dulled by the oppressive gloom, and the youngest children dragged those hurt too badly to fight further back onto the hillside. There was little that could be done for them, but they could do no more good in the fighting ranks. Maeve wiped her sword blade on the grass at her feet and gave her daughter a weak smile. Ulrich's face was flushed with a mixture of fear and excitement, the adrenaline of battle outweighing the thought of facing an army of the dead. There was no time for words, for the ranks of skeleton warriors in ancient armour were almost upon them. The wolves had been nothing more than a skirmish screen to protect the warriors following behind. The dead were less than 50 paces from the Azaborns, marching in perfect lockstep. Behind them, the vampire and his horsemen walked their skeletal steeds up the hill, ready to ride down any mortals who fled the field of battle. Cold dread settled in Maeve's bones, a terrible, suffocating fear of losing everything that she loved in one fell swoop. She looked into the eyes of the vampire lord, seeing a lifetime of cruelty and evil. She saw his blood hunger. And as his army marched onwards, she heard a thunderous rumble, a drumming on the earth like a distant thunderstorm drawing closer with every passing moment. A wild series of horn blasts swept the hillside as a dozen ululating brays came from the trees behind the Azaborn battle line.
what new horror had appeared behind them without warning. She had been so sure the dead would come at them head-on that she hadn't even considered the possibility that their flank could be turned. The horns blew again, and Maeve's heart leapt as she recognised the sound of Unberogan war horns. Shapes moved through the trees, galloping horsemen in their hundreds. But far from being riders of the dead, these were living, breathing warriors atop wide-shouldered, powerful steeds clad in heavy hauberks of iron scale. The riders thundered over the brow of the hill, and Maeve let loose a wild Azaborn war shout as she recognised the warriors at the head of the Unberogan horsemen. One she called Emperor, and the other she called Husband. Sigmar and Wulfgart rode over the brow of the hill, weapons unsheathed and ready to fight to save those they held dear. Hundreds of Unberogan riders streamed past Maeve, along with scores of horsemen armoured in mail shirts and bronze breastplates with blood-red cloaks. Maeve recognised them as Teuton redscythes, and their crimson pennoned lances lowered in glittering unison. Galmaraz swept up, a shaft of brilliant sunlight breaking through the unnatural gloom to strike the Emperor's mighty warhammer and banish the darkness. Sigmar rode through the trees with his long hair unbound and his armour glowing with impossible radiance. Such was the skill of his riders that they rode through the Azaborn battle lines without trampling those they had come to rescue. The charge of the Unberogan and Teuton cavalry was ferocious, and it struck the line of the dead with unstoppable force. The red scythes leaned into their stirrups, and their lances punched into the ranks of the dead, skewering skeletal champions and hoisting them from the ground. Lances splintered with the impact, and the riders drew heavy maces and morning stars as they plunged into the undead host. Wulfgart's vast sword, forged by Govanan less than a year ago, swept from its shoulder scabbard, and no sooner was its blade bared than it clove through the chest of an undead warrior clad in a rusted shirt of mail. Swords and axes smashed through bone and patchwork plates of bronze and iron. The dead reeled from the sudden attack, but did not break. Though hundreds were destroyed in the opening moments of the Unberogan charge, hundreds more remained to fight. Sigmar's cavalry plunged into the heart of the dead, breaking them apart as they split the host in two. The dead cared nothing for the suddenness of the attack, and merely turned to face the horsemen whose charge began to slow with the press of skeletal bodies. Sigmar fought at the centre of the dead army, the skull splitter living up to its name as it shattered bone and pulverised armour with every blow. The dead tried to pull away from Sigmar, but he rode into them with ever greater force, destroying half a dozen with every blow. Maeve lifted her sword and charged after the horsemen, and the Azaborns followed her. Alaric's dwarfs marched towards the dead, cutting through their mouldering ranks like loggers in a forest of saplings. The fear that touched mortal hearts seemed not to have so strong a hold on the dwarfs, and they broke through with sweeping strokes of their axes. Though the dead outnumbered the living by nearly 2-1, the dead could not match the skill of those ranged against them. Sigmar aimed his horse toward the white-cloaked vampire, but if he sought a duel with the blood drinker, he was to be denied satisfaction. Sensing defeat for his host, the blood drinker turned and rode away, his black horsemen galloping south as the allies turned to fight the remaining undead warriors. Attacked from the front and rear and abandoned by their maker, the host of the dead began to waver, their physical forms unravelling in the face of mortal courage and vitality. The battle was far from over, but without the power of the vampire to bind the dark energies that held them together, the dead were falling apart with every passing moment, like ice before the summer sun. Horsemen rode through the dead, hacking them down with brutal sweeps of their swords, while the Azaborns hemmed them in and the dwarves trampled them with the pounding force of their relentless advance. Sigmar and Wulfgart rode pell-mell through the diminishing host, their weapons reaping a magnificent tally of the dead. Though it took another hour, the dead could not long linger, and as the last of the sepulchral twilight faded from the sky, the field belonged to the living. Sigmar turned his horse and it reared up, pawing the air in triumph, but Maeve cared nothing for the sight. She threw her weapon aside and ran towards her husband with her daughter in tow. Wulfgart saw them coming and leapt from his horse, sweeping his wife and daughter into his arms and holding them so tightly she thought he might break them. He kissed Maeve over and over, and the intensity of the kiss was magnified tenfold by the nearness of death. Weeping with relief and the fear of what might have been lost, Wulfgart, Maeve, and Ulrich laughed and cried to be reunited. The bitterness and rancor of what had driven them apart, forgotten in the rush of joy sweeping through them.
"You came for us," said Maeve between breaths. "I wished for it, and you came."
"Of course I came for you," said Wulfgart, unashamed tears spilling down his face. "You're my woman, and I love you. And you're my little girl," he added, dropping to his knees to hug Ulrich.
"I thought we'd never see you again," cried Ulrich.
"Never think that, my beautiful girl," said Wulfgart. "No matter what happens, I'll always be there for you. Not even death can stop me from coming to you." They stayed locked together for many minutes, savouring this moment of reunion, until a horseman rode up to them, and Maeve knew who it would be before she even opened her eyes.
"Sigmar," she said,
only reluctantly releasing her grip on Wulfgart and giving a short bow to the Emperor.
"Your timing couldn't be better. You saved us, and you have my undying gratitude."
Sigmar smiled and said, "It's your husband you should thank. I was riding for Reichdorf when my outriders saw them heading east. I wanted to know where he was going with 600 of my best horsemen, and he told me you were in danger."
"The Oathstone showed me this battle," said Wulfgart. "I don't know how, Maeve, but it did. We hand-fastened over it, so maybe there's some lingering magic from that moment, something that brought me to you when you needed me most. I gathered up everyone I could to ride east. Turns out a lot of people wanted to help me."
"I know," said Sigmar, seeing her look of confusion. "I didn't believe him either, but he swore he'd ride east alone if need be, so I thought I'd best keep him safe for you."
"I'm grateful," said Maeve.
Sigmar was about to reply when she saw a shocked expression freeze upon his face. He was looking past her, and Maeve knew what it would be before she turned around. At the top of the hill, Sigulf and Fridlifer laughed and cheered as Gar and the Queen's eagles blooded their cheeks.
"Who are those boys?" demanded Sigmar.
Wulfgart caught up to Sigmar by the river. The Emperor's head was bowed, and his arms were folded across his chest as he stared off into the distance. This was going to be difficult, and Wulfgart took a deep breath as he approached. Right here, right now, Sigmar was not the Emperor, not the ruler of the lands from the Grey Mountains to the Sea of Claws. He was simply his friend. Sigmar turned his head as he approached, but said nothing. They stood by the fast-flowing river, enjoying the sights and sounds and smells of a land resurgent after the touch of undeath. Water splashed over rocks and gurgled in pools by the riverbank. Birdsong had returned to the world, not the raucous cawing of ravens and crows, but the wondrously refreshing and hopeful warbling of songbirds. Wulfgart hadn't realized how much he'd missed the birds until now. The sky was a shimmering canopy of blue, the clouds scattered and white. It was the perfect day, but for the tension in Sigmar's body.
"They are Freya's sons, aren't they?"
"Yes."
"And I am their father," stated Sigmar.
Wulfgart nodded, though there was no need. It hadn't been a question.
"You knew about them, didn't you?" said Sigmar.
Wulfgart knew there was no need or good to be served by lying.
"I did, but Maeve swore me to silence." "And you don't break an oath to an Azerborn woman," said Sigmar.
"Not if you want to keep your manhood intact," agreed Wulfgart, knowing he had let Maeve down once already with his oaths.
"I understand why she wouldn't want me to know," said Sigmar. "Freya's not the family type. Not for her husband and a doting father."
"No," agreed Wulfgart. "She's not really cut out to be the faithful wife either."
"But they are my sons," said Sigmar, finally turning to face Wulfgart. "I had a right to know them, to watch them grow up and become men. They are the sons I never had with Ravina. Who will carry on my name when I'm dead? Wulfgart, who?"
"There's still time, my friend," said Wulfgart. "You're not too old to sire sons, and there's plenty of strong women who'd be proud to bear them." Sigmar shook his head and knelt beside the river bank, plucking a flat stone with a smooth face from the earth. He skimmed it across the water, watching as it skipped over the surface a number of times before sinking.
"I remember doing this as a child, and it still makes me smile."
Wulfgar picked up a similar stone and skipped it across the water. His throw was better and made it farther across the river before sinking.
"You always were lousy at this," said Wulfgar, stooping to pick up another stone. "It's all in the wrist, you see. Here, like this."
Once again, the stone skipped across the river, but Sigmar shook his head.
"I am who I am, Wulfgar, and it's too late for me to change. Ravina was my love, and I swore that there would be no other."
"You can change that, Sigmar," said Wulfgar. "You can get to know those boys. They're good lads, strong and brave, reckless and full of the same fire that drove you to build the Empire. Who knows what they might do with you as their father to guide them?"
"I wish it could be that easy, my friend," replied Sigmar. "But I am on a path that does not allow change. Others have that luxury, but I do not. The Empire needs me as I am, a warrior emperor."
"And what about what you need? Love, companionship, family?"
"I cannot be the man this land needs if I am drawn to hearth and home," said Sigmar, looking over his shoulder to the Azaborns as they prepared to march west to Reichdorf. Freya's boys and Ulrich gathered around Maeve like chicks around a mother hen.
"Those boys don't need me. They're Azaborns," said Sigmar. "Their mother would never allow me to take them from her. That's what she fears, that I'll take them to Reichdorf and make them my heirs."
"You should," said Wulfgar. "They are your sons, after all. Doesn't the Empire need heirs, strong rulers to carry your name into the future? You said so yourself."
Sigmar turned to look out over the landscape, and Wulfgar saw the beginnings of a smile crack his features. "Aye, the Empire needs heirs," said Sigmar, slapping a hand on Wulfgar's shoulder and walking him back to the column of people. "And you are all my heirs. Everyone who lives in this land is my heir. Everyone who fights and bleeds to protect the Empire."
The Emperor smiled. "They will all be Sigmar's heirs."